Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Stir Crazy Podcast. My name is Rob Nelson.
And I'm Mike Bakov. And hey, Rob, I usually have a pun at this point in the podcast, but I can't come up with one on the fly.
Well, you know what they say, one pun in the hand is worth two in the bush, I think.
Because we are talking all things feathered, all things flying, all things with a beak and tails and feathers and everything else, because we are coming right up on the 33rd annual Wings Over the Platte art exhibit and sale, right?
Absolutely. We are taking on a two-part episode on the history of flight, and we go back into prehistoric times and all the way up to the present. So we're talking about natural flight and also in the 20th century, aeronautical flight with people as well.
Yeah. This first episode, the first half that you're listening to right now, is going to feature Casanova and Carrie Stouffer and Carly Kramers from our education department, who are going to talk a lot about the history of flight. And then we dive into nature photography with this year's featured artist, who is Doug Stanky, correct?
That is correct. And he is a photographer of all things nature, wildlife, waterfowl, and his artwork is going to be on exhibit in the Stir building during the Wings Over the Platte exhibit starting on February 12th. So we encourage everybody to come check out that after you listen to this amazing podcast.
Yeah, see the show. And it was a very good conversation. So if this conversation is at all interesting to you, Wings Over the Platte is going to be definitely something you want to check out.
Yeah, absolutely. With that, let's jump in with both wings.
Ah, terrible.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Stir Crazy Podcast. As always, my name is Rob Nelson. I'll be your host. I'm joined today with expert extraordinaire of Stir Museum, Casanova, another expert extraordinaire, Carrie Stouffer, and new first time on the show, resident expert, Carly Kramers.
I don't get to be an expert extraordinaire. I haven't worked up to that yet.
Sorry about that. You'll grow into it.
You have to do a couple podcasts before you get to that point, Spare.
Today, we are addressing the first half of a two-part episode covering the history of flight. And how that's going to work is, in this episode, we are going to talk more about the natural history of flight involving the crane migration over the Central Platte Valley of Nebraska, which we are fast approaching at the current moment. And in the second episode of the history of flight, we're going to be talking more about the aeronautics and recent history of machine flight technology / engineering. Let's just jump right in and get talking about the Sandhill Cranes. So I think a good place to begin would be for those who have never seen or had the fortune of seeing this creature, how would one describe a Sandhill Crane?
It's gray.
Gray.
Okay. Red crown.
Tall.
Very tall.
Very tall.
Yeah. Broad 5 feet tall.
Yeah.
Their wings can go about over 6 feet.
So that means if they're 5 feet tall, they could more
aggressive.
Or less almost look me in the eye. Because I'm a little over that. So
yeah, definitely.
As far as I know, they aren't as mean as geese, luckily. Otherwise, they could sure as heck take people out.
Well, around here, we don't have to worry about getting close to the nest, so we don't really know for sure.
That's true.
Yeah, that's one thing they warn you about, not to get close, not to get off the road. Don't go out and see them.
Right.
They'll give you a good kick. You'll be down.
Oh, boy.
Well, I imagine the beaks would hurt.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They have very long, narrow beaks.
Yes.
And I think what's exciting about them coming through this area is that this is the largest concentration during a migration, and it's one of the longest migrations from Mexico up to Canada and even into parts of Russia.
Yeah, and these birds, the oldest fossil they've found is about 2.5 million years old, which they found that fossil in Florida, so they've been on this path for years and years, and the Platte River's only been around for 10,000 years, but ever since then, we've been a pit stop for them.
Yeah, and it's been this place in central Nebraska that entire time.
It's called a major flyway, and there's a lot of birds that come through here, and the sandhill and the whooping are just a small part of that.
That's very true.
What is it about this this particular climate or region of the country that makes these birds want to come here so habitually?
Well, if you look at how this region developed, I mean, originally we had ocean here, and then as that receded, you have a lot of kind of like a marshland type thing, which down in their southern home is kind of a lot like what they're used to. So I imagine that they became very comfortable, and it's probably technically sort of midway in their path to their summer grounds?
Actually, up in Canada, it's kind of marshy too, which is where they're summering and having their families. But even, I think it's the Platte River is a big part of it. And as this, the region changed, and, you know, you would think as the Platte River got smaller, because it has, and changed, you know, different channels, that that would affect them. But I think the farming around here kind of keeps them coming, because now they just have an abundance of, you know, extra corn and grain and slugs. I mean, they eat everything.
Yeah. They're on the board.
Crustaceans still, even in this area. So you wouldn't think of it, but it's a good place for them to eat.
And they're gone by the time the farmers plant their first seeds. So it's, they just take whatever is left over and then they're out. And it's kind of crazy to think that, you know, corn hasn't been here for that long of a time, but it's become a big part of their diet for when they're here. So I think it shows how extraordinary of creatures they are to have survived 2.5 million years with this really quick evolutionary style.
It just, just really shows how well they adapt to the changes.
Yeah. We're like that really good gas station for them. We're like, you're on your trip.
If you think about it, I mean, with traffic and cars and buildings going up, I mean,
and tourists that, coming to see them all the time, gawking at them.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that they're still around, and that, you know, you can hit it where 500,000 cranes land in front of you.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome to be out in a field or close by a field and watch landings, takeoffs, and just watch them behave in the field.
Yeah, their communication style, they jump, they flap their wings, they do dances for their mating, and because they're so large, even if they're far away, you can see all of that, and they're very loud too.
I like hearing when they're flying over, because you can always tell the sound of a crane as opposed to geese or something like that. And it's always, you always can tell when you start hearing that first.
It says you can hear them up to 2 miles away.
I believe it.
Because they have their vocal, the way they make the sound starts in their stomach, and kind of is like a French horn that projects out. So
neat.
I don't think I could explain the science behind that, but it's like a French horn.
Okay.
So everyone's talking like they've already clearly viewed the cranes for themselves in person. I have not personally. And I'm curious as to, you know, how long ago was it that people starting taking note of this phenomena taking place, their migration?
Well, I'm certain that the Pawnee were very aware of them. I looked for any documented accounts, and I personally didn't find any. I don't know if anybody else found anything on that. I'm sure that there are some. It's just a matter of finding the source.
Well, I think the source, because I know we don't have it around here, but down in Oklahoma where the Pawnee were relocated and they have their museum and all that information, they do have some sources there. So I think it's a road trip for all of us to take at some point.
I've actually been in Pawnee a couple times. They have a really neat, really unique visitor center there. Of course, right now this was, you know, I would visit post-pandemic times, but
all right,
we would have to wait. But they have some really neat things down there. It's well worth the trip.
So what kind of cultural impact have these cranes had on this community of Hall County, Nebraska? I know there's a pretty lengthy history now of, you know, their involvement for the last 100, at least 120 years or so, I think, you know, settlers of the Hall County region have taken note of this. Not really any further than that is what I have seen, because travelers in this part of the country came a lot later than in other parts of the country, like the Mormon Trail, the Oregon Trail, you know, that's mid-19th century, and their travels are taking place after the spring months, which is why they don't, you don't see very many accounts. Yeah, they miss,
by the time they're crossing the plains on the trail, they've already missed that migration season. So they, chances are they did not, unless they were coming really early, they are not going to have seen any of the crane migration.
I mean, the time of year really follows the same as it did back then. So we're talking by mid-April, they're gone.
They're gone, and, they start early. Arriving sometimes in February. So that's not a time when you're going to be crossing the plains with wagons.
That's the time when you're going to start crossing. crossing the plains. By the time you're gonna start preparing,
you might not cross the plains at that time. So,
so when is this kind of phenomenon started to be really popular in the minds of Hall County or Central Nebraska residents?
Well, I started to take a look at the Hall County newspapers, and the earliest account that I found was the Grand Island Times, 1879, and I still haven't finished looking through all of the pages and pages of hits for cranes in there, but this is fall, September of 1879. Sandhill cranes are coming down from the north and whoopering up along the streams. So I thought that was an interesting little tidbit about that. The other thing that is appearing in those newspapers is they also touch on cranes in Florida. Mm-hmm. And they talk about the nesting areas and things like that. So that ends up getting reported in that.
I found something in the Grand Island Independent from August 28, 1889, where it's talking about several Orlando families have pet sandhill cranes.
Yes.
And they say they're very alert and very watchful.
They actually still have those in Florida.
What?
Yeah,
in Florida.
Yeah, they have like mascot cranes. And actually on the flyway in Wisconsin, they have cranes that stick around. And, you know, here we have like different families of geese that don't actually migrate.
Yeah, they just hang.
They just hang. So like in Florida, they have big old cranes that just hang out and on golf courses.
Oh,
and
my.
Yeah.
It's just... One year, D.H. Talbot in 1884 is cranes wanted until November 1, 1884. I will pay 50 cents for each sandhill cranes and $1 each for the white ones, provided they are delivered to me in the flesh and fresh. Deliver to me at Williams Ford or send by express at my expense to Wood River, Nebraska, D.H. Talbot. It doesn't exactly say what D.H. Talbot is doing with said cranes, but there's a lot of reports. There's a later report about how Nebraska's or Hall County's considered a really good place to get cranes for taxidermy purposes.
Oh.
So.
And that's kind of speaking to the question I raised a little bit earlier, but I think we jumped past or I talked over somebody. The cultural impact of these cranes, you know, they've impacted in so many ways. In case hitting on one of them, what other ways, you know, did cranes play a role in the lives of these community members?
Well, I found something where one was made into a crane pot pie, and
oh, really?
This is in Grand Island Independent, 1895. So they obviously didn't have the hunting laws that we do now. Since now we realize the value of the bird, that it's such an old species that we want to protect it, because there was some massive hunting for a while before it became legal. But it says, Ed Koons, with one fell swoop, has established his reputation as a Nimrod. And I also thought, why is someone being called a Nimrod in the paper? But turns out it means good hunter originally.
Yes.
There you go.
The more you know. So,
yeah. I think you should explain how it changed from good hunter, because that is like even more, I think, exciting
yeah.
to me.
Yeah, if you look up on Google, definition one is a good hunter. Definition two is an inept person. And I was like, how is there a disconnect? But in Bugs Bunny, back in that cartoon where he would always call the hunter a Nimrod, because Nimrod means hunter, but everyone thought, Nimrod means not smart person. The more you know. So, yeah, he, in one fell swoop, got to these sandhill cranes, and one of them was delivered to the reverend's wife, who made a crane pot pie, and they thought that it would just be consisted of sand, bill, and legs, but yeah. The reverend said it was juicy and succulent and made for excellent eating. Don't try that today, though. That is illegal.
However, in the state of Nebraska.
Oh.
Because they
want to protect the birds, because there are so many here at one time. If you're down in Texas, they call it the ribeye of the sky.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I'm sure they'll let you make a pot pie.
Yes.
Oh, in Florida as well, probably.
Just another road trip, right?
I don't know if I want to eat it.
In 1894, in the Evening Times, there's an educational column. And at one point it says, few people appreciate the fact that many of our species of animals are rapidly becoming extinct. Hall County has the reputation among taxidermists of being the best county in the state for native Nebraska birds. Yet many of these are becoming scarce. Whooping cranes dead, or rather their skins, are worth $5. 2 years ago, a standing offer of $5 per skin was sent to Grand Island taxidermist. Yet whooping cranes are being shot every day and thrown to the hogs. This fact of the threatened extinction of many animals has been recognized by our government, and about 3 years ago, a sort of national park for the preservation of the species was laid out just north of the city of Washington on Rock Creek.
Well, and I think that's a good cultural reference or good cultural impact, or at least significant, like you were talking about, Rob, is that, you know, now, because of those laws that Kay is reading about and because of all of that, that's really the commerce around the cranes now. We've got tourism. Mm-hmm. We've got several different conservation societies and businesses around here. We have a lot of studies done here. People from Florida, from Wisconsin, they come here and, you know, collaborate with our flyway. So it's really kind of changed the culture in that way too.
Yeah, and just in doing some digging about like the modern phenomena of the tourism surrounding the cranes, it seems to me that the consensus is the tourism industry around this area grew in the 1970s following things like the Endangered Species Act of 1973 and more attention just really being focused and, you know, on these birds and wanting to protect this migration pattern that had existed for thousands, if not millions of years. And there's also a few movies that came out around that same time in the 70s. There was a film with Wild Kingdoms, A Day with the Sandhill Cranes, that came out in 1977, I guess, that was a big deal. That one just went over my head. I never saw it either. But apparently that had a little bit of success as well, and it drew some attention to the industry. And, of course, the birding culture now that is very popular is...
Well, and as a kid, I didn't pay attention. I was born and raised here. I did not pay attention to the crane migration. It wasn't until I was well into adulthood that there was more emphasis on the travel and the tourism behind the cranes here in central Nebraska. So it's something that has grown and evolved over time.
Well, and I think bigger, there's bigger connections with the artwork and with conservation and things. And so, you know, you've got artists like Thomas Mangelson,
yes,
who's in the area, and you've got Jane Goodall visiting, mm-hmm, and doing a lot of work on making sure that we do right by the cranes. And I think every little bit of attention, you know, and then the more people you get to experience, you know, even more so when the 500,000 cranes lift off,
yeah,
and your heart takes off with it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's endearing. It's not, you may ignore it while you're a child, but once you go out there and experience it, it is definitely something to take hold.
Yeah, they really are stunning creatures. It's hard to deny that.
Yeah, Carrie draws attention to the artwork that has come about as a result of this, you know, famous migration. The Wings Over the Platte exhibit, which opens February 12th and runs until April 4th at Sturm Museum, celebrates this migration. And actually, in the second half of this episode, we are going to be talking with the featured artist of that exhibit, whose name is Doug Stanky. So that is a conversation I'm greatly looking forward to. So let's take a break, and we'll be back after these words with artist from the Wings Over the Platte exhibit, Doug Stanky. We'll be right back.
Today's podcast is brought to you by General Mercantile Emporium, offering general lines of parasols, pickles, gloves, books, and candy. The finest goods are always available at the General Mercantile Emporium, Front Street, Railroad Town, Nebraska. Mrs. L. Condon, proprietor.
Welcome back to the Stir Crazy podcast. I'm here with featured artist for the Wings Over the Platte exhibit, Doug Stanky. Doug, thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we were talking in the previous segment about the crane migration and just wildlife in general in Nebraska, so we figured who better to bring in than a wildlife photographer. First question I'll just throw to you is, how has the wildlife of Nebraska inspired your artwork?
It's kind of everything that's centered around everything that I've ever, hobbies, interests, things like that, always been around it. And I don't know. I guess it was just a natural progression.
Yeah.
To go out and take photos of everything, but yeah.
Why did you gravitate towards photography?
I mean, it started when I was a little kid. I grew up in Holdridge, Nebraska.
Okay.
So we would have, you know, huge migrations go through there every spring. And I remember being a little kid, maybe in fourth grade, and you'd get one of those Kodak. In fact, my parents just gave me the camera about 6 months ago. It was one of those Kodaks where you click it and you got, it was like, it looked like a rectangle block, you know, and they gave me a camera. And so I would, whenever a flock of birds would fly over, flock of ducks would fly over the house, I would try to take a photo of them, or we'd go out to Sacramento. My dad would take me out there and go look at birds and things like that. But yeah, that's when I first started taking photos. And then when I was in college, I did, that was kind of, that was a main hobby of mine in college, but it would just cost too much.
Sure.
You know, I remember saving, I wouldn't go to a bar.
Oh, really?
I remember one spring break, I didn't go anywhere. I saved all my money, and I was so excited because I bought 800 and 1600 ISO black and white film, and I was going to take all these, I rented a photo from, like, I think it was Harman Camera in Lincoln, and it was going to be awesome. And I shot through about, I don't know, $100 of film in one day. And I was like, I still had another week of school or spring break left. And yeah.
Were you just around campus doing that?
No, this was when I came back home to Holdridge. Yeah. So I had a lot of friends that farm north of town, you know, up by the river and that. So I could get access and kind of take photos of ducks and geese mostly.
I know we were talking the other day briefly, but I was going to ask you to go into a little bit more detail about just your process about how you choose where you're going to shoot. I know you say sometimes just like there's a dirt road that's calling your name and you just head down it.
Yeah. You could track me like a whitetail. I mean, you can print like, because I've already, you know, because in another week or so, I'm going to be going to Funk Lagoon. That's where I grew up at. I used to roam around Funk Lagoon when it was private. I had a friend that, we, you know, back then you could get on a lot of ground, just especially if you're a kid and hunting, you could pretty, or if they knew your dad, you could get on ground. So we used to hunt Funk Lagoon a lot. So I always like to go back there and start. That's where I'll start every spring. I'll go see what the water looks like, if there is any water. It's like now I don't think there's much there, even though they'll probably start pumping here, you know, a little bit. So a lot of that, taking, especially in that Holdridge area, I'll try to find some old haunts that I was at growing up. And then I'll venture out and just see what's going on. Go to the eastern basins or go out west. And so like this year, I'm really going to go. This year I was exposed to Crescent Wildlife.
Sure.
Up north of Oshkosh. So I'm probably going to be spending a lot of time up there. Maybe April, May, you know, something like that. I think that'd be fun to go up there.
Gotcha. You know, we're sitting here in central Nebraska. There's such a, you know, the culture of this part of the state is mm-hmm. all about the outdoors and fishing and hunting. And,
yeah.
You know, you said that you kind of got into that in an early age. Is that something that's been in your family for
you know,
as many generations back as it can be?
Yeah, I can always, yeah. My dad would always take myself and my brother fishing and hunting, or he would always drag us along. And so now, like, I have three boys now, and really only one of them likes to do any of that. Just like my brother growing up, he didn't really care for it, you know, but you know, they all have their own interests, but yeah. So and that just kind of progressed. Whenever I have time, I'm always on the outside. I never want to be inside.
Speaking as a city kid, I've been on all of those sorts of things. I've never mm-hmm. really been hunting,
yeah.
but I've done a fair amount of fishing in my life.
Yeah.
But, I've always just been curious as to, you know, what is it about these two hobbies that,
yeah.
you know, creates this culture?
Well, I think there's a trophy aspect to it. You know, everybody wants to go. I mean, my niche is the waterfowl world. You know, that's where most of my photography, and that's where I'm known for. But in that little genre, I'm really known for phases. I like to searching out all the phases. So just like fishing in that, you know, you go fishing once and you You like it or you don't. You go back. I want to catch one fish. Then I want to catch a limit. Then I want to catch the biggest fish. Then I want to catch the fish the way I want to catch it. And then you just want to go. And yeah, so both hunting and fishing, I'm kind of in that just want to go stage. I've kind of been through it all. But I think it's traditions, you know. And most of the people that I'm hunting with now, I'm 52, but a lot of them are in their 60s, early 70s. And then I've got, my sons and his friends. But yeah, a lot of the times it's just going. It's a matter. I think it's about the process of the traditions of going. And I used to hunt on a property by Overton for 40 years. And I never, like now, I don't miss shooting a bird, but I miss going out and setting up the blinds and trying to figure out where things are going to be, or just sitting there on the bank, you know, just watching fall go by, you know, things like that. I miss the process. I like the process of it. And I think that's what a lot of people are drawn to. So like Thanksgiving, you know, everybody's got a traditional hunt or deer hunting or anything like that. You know, I think it's a more of a traditional camaraderie type of deal, family get together.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, the tradition plays a huge part in it. I always thought there was kind of like a life lessons component, especially like the parent to child, you know, whether that's mom or dad or boy or girl, like just, you know, especially now with, you know, if you can't put a phone away, teaching patience, you know, or like maybe it's an all day process hunting an animal, whatever it is, you know. Or same thing with fishing, like it's going to be, maybe it'll be a few hours before you even get anything, or maybe you never get anything.
Yeah.
And you know, responsibility for all sorts of stuff, like the equipment, the, you know, the clothing, maybe it's
all that.
Yeah.
I think it's everything that you allude to. I think it's, yeah, I think you're right on. It's because you can get gear, you know, like this week I ordered another camera. So it's just,
exactly.
It's just a progression. And in fact, this morning, I went down a rabbit hole and was looking on how to tie a certain fly that I saw on a video. So, yeah, acquiring more things. And
I've always wanted to get into fly fishing. It's really like a lifelong.
Just enough that I've talked to you, you get sucked into it.
I know.
It's because it's just exaggerated. Everything's exaggerated in fly fishing. The trip. You got the trip and then you got throwing, you know, the fly and the fly line, and it's melodic, and it seems like it's not just throwing something out and reeling it in. There's more than that, because it's more, it is like hunting.
I think it's a craft.
It's exactly like that. But I think people get scared and intimidated by it, because you want to have the perfect cast, you know, and the first time you pick up a fly rod and you're just like, oh, this is never going to work. And so like when I teach kids or even a friend how to do it, and you know, they go on YouTube and look at it and try to figure out what to do. And I said, no, just get it there. Just get it. Just get that fly out there and just try to just go for it. Just try to athletically get it out there. And you just figure out a way to do it. It may not look pretty, but within 15 minutes, you know enough by not even giving you a lesson that you're good to go.
And like anything, the more you do it, the better you're going to get at it. And nothing really worthwhile you should be good at, in my opinion, in the first couple of minutes. So
yeah, that's what some of my friends and I are talking about, going out to Colorado or somewhere here shortly, maybe in February, and just miss the action of throwing, just the cast. That's, you don't have to catch anything. You can just cast all day. And at least that's what, I don't know. Yeah, but you would like it. I bet you would. Yeah.
I know. I think you're right. I would get sucked in.
And you can do it anywhere. That's the great thing. I do more fly fishing in Nebraska than I do in Colorado or Wyoming.
Really?
It's amazing. It's just another technique. It's just like, people just think it's this, you know, magical, you know, it's just river runs through. It's above. No, it's just another technique to deliver a fly. It's more of a, it's like walleyes. you have a really hard time catching walleyes because walleyes want a more vertical up and down type of presentation, like a jig or something like that, where actually a fly is a lot like a jerkbait. You're just, it's a more of a horizontal presentation that you can do. You can use jigs and clousers and all that, but for the most part, yeah, it's just another horizontal presentation that you can stop and the fly kind of breathes. And yeah, it's just another technique. Just sure. That's all it gets down to.
Well, we were kind of talking about
the
people that we interact with while hunting or fishing. And I know a huge component of your artwork is the human element in your artwork. And I was just wondering if you could kind of talk a little bit more about that, like what got you into capturing that aspect of things.
Yeah, I think when I first started taking photos, my goal was to get in Ducks Unlimited. And, you know, that was kind of playing for the Yankees, you know, and I think it still is to a point, you know, but back, you know, 15 years ago when I started, that was the pinnacle. That's, if you could get in there, you were something. And I tried for a couple of years to get in and just never, you know, cause everybody wants that full frame front page,
sure,
canvas back gliding in or something like that. But when I was taking photos, how I first got at taking photos, I would do all that, but I worked for a company, this Avery Outdoors, and I would take product photos for them. And to take product photos, you need humans in them. And I think it helps that I had kids. I think there's more of an emotional component to it. Mm-hmm. And it seems, you don't have to be as technical. You don't have to be perfect. And it's like the conversation we had coming in here. I wish I could find that. It's such an eloquent quote, but it's by Joe McNally. But basically the premise of the quote is when you have a photo and you're looking at a photo with no humans in it, you notice all the imperfections.
Sure.
You know, it may not be symmetrical, or contrast may not be right. The focus point may not be right. You know, you start noticing everything. But so you put in a photo, or so say like I have that photo in the mountains of my friend Terry. He's fishing, throwing the fly rod. And if you look at it, I mean, there's some imperfections in there. I mean, if you really look at it, but no, all you see is him and the fly rod. And throwing, you know, and the line, and you instantly can put yourself in that photo. And that was Joe McNally's premise, is that once you humanize a photo, you've already made that mental leap of putting yourself in the photo, and you don't notice the imperfections because your mind is already wondering. It's already made that emotional connection to it. And it's when you do that, especially like when you do a fuzzed out, or if you're shooting back from somebody, or especially when you can't see a face, it's easier for you to make that mental leap that you could put yourself in that situation. And that's really my secret for a lot of things. And I think that's, so when back getting the Ducks Unlimited back 15 years ago, there weren't a lot of people that were really, I don't think, taking that type of photo. Well, I know there wasn't. And I just happened to take those type of shots. What are now, you know, the cool kids now called lifestyle shots, you know,
sure.
On Instagram. You know, I was taking lifestyle photos back then. And that was one of the things too, is that all my friends that I hunt with, they would make fun of me. And they were like, well, I can pick out your photos in DU because they're all the photos without ducks in them.
Yeah.
And they were all with humans. And they were all with granddads and grandkids and guys having, you know, walking on the river or sitting in the duck blind or having coffee or, well, it's like the one in the photo we have in the exhibit. My friend Kevin Jenny and his dog in the cup of coffee. I mean, that was...
Buddies.
It was like, don't move, you know? And I was like, yeah, it's like... everybody can put themselves in who's duck hunted, or at least can put their granddad in that situation or anything like that. And so, yeah, it's, so your photo doesn't have to be exactly perfect, because, and I think that helps. And I've got a niche for that. I really, And I do, like, even the photos I was telling you about today, I was sorting. I went through 3,000 photos in the last 2 weeks, and 2,800 out of the 3,000 have humans in it. And it's just, that's just my style of shooting. It's just what I really like. And yeah, it's what I like to do.
No, I get it. I think that's an interesting, I wish I did know the quote, but like you say that when you start noticing the imperfections, mm-hmm. when there's no people in it, it's like, and I do that. I think everybody might do that too. Even when you're taking a picture on your phone or whatever, is you're kind of trying for that screensaver moment,
yeah,
or something. So you want the tree exactly in that place and the sun exactly in that place. And yeah, so you're kind of, if without people in it, you're sort of removing that experience, and you just kind of, you're trying to create something, whereas the moment's naturally happening, maybe if there's a human in it.
Yes. Yeah.
And yeah. That's a great way to look at it. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. Maybe it's spontaneous. Maybe, you know, people, because a lot of people will say that a lot of my photos are spontaneous, or they look spontaneous, or they're indirectly spontaneous. You know, we'll be out on a photo shoot for a product or something, and it's never the shot that you really want. It's always the shot behind the scene. It's like there's another photo in the exhibit of my son and the golden, where the sun rays are coming through him. And my other son was, he dropped something and he was picking it up, and my son was just super cold, and he just stood there with his head down. And I went, again, one of those don't move moments, but it wasn't planned. It was spontaneous, and bang, you got that shot. But I think everybody wants that screensaver shot, and I even get stuck in it. Even last week, I was looking through what I've shot this fall, and I just got depressed because nothing is that screensaver moment.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I'll show, my wife will be standing over my shoulder at the kitchen and looking. Well, that one's great. Well, that's good. Well, that one's awesome. Well, I like what you did there. And I'm like, I just took it. So, you know, wasn't trying. Seems like when you try to be perfect, mm-hmm. it just doesn't work, which is bad, because then you're like always hoping for that magical moment to show up, and it might be 3 years from now. You never know.
And sometimes maybe that magical moment repeats itself every day for 20 years. Like I think my favorite picture that you have in the exhibit is called The Boys, and it's these four gentlemen who every single day
had
the same cup of coffee in the same place outside of the bait and tackle shop.
It is. And that's a great example of, I'd seen that shot. And we've talked about that before. I'd seen that shot for a couple of years. And I just told him, one of these days I'm going to take your photo. And but that's the type of, it's weird that I notice cranes and ducks and geese and the nature and things like that. But that human moment, in the outdoor world, I just can identify it just instantaneous. And I know that it's like, so with that photo, it was Al Van Borkelen at Van's Lakeview. And they would, every morning when the shop would open up at 7 o'clock, they would all meet down there for coffee, and they'd all sit on that bench and they would have coffee every morning. And for years, I mean, he was just the trademark with the cowboy hat and just an icon. And then it was about 6 months after that photo, Al got sick and died. And I know every one of those guys on that bench just, you know, I mean, they cried like little babies.
Because
it's just that type of a devastating type of image capture that it is. And I can think back to the photos I've taken, and it's not the ones of birds. It's people out hunting, or like dogs. Dogs are a big deal. It's funny how when you're a photographer and you do these sort of things, so when you do a lot of waterfowl hunting, you're around a lot of dogs, and for some reason or another, they get hit by a car, or their stomach flips over when they're eating, or they just have a cancer and die, but hardly anybody's got photos of their dogs. Well, now they do with their phones. They got quite a few, but back then they didn't. But it was weird how I was starting to get these phone calls from friends. Hey, my dog passed away. Do you have any photos? Or a wife will call me and say, hey, you know, my husband's dog passed away. Do you have anything? And literally, it could be the worst photo you think it is. It's not sharp. But the dog is coming back, just running. I mean, not even a bird. But you just get a photo of the dog coming back to the guy. And that's all you need. And that's it. It's not a screensaver moment, but for them, it's the only thing they have. And so with the progression of that, it's now I have friends, you know, you get a phone call from somebody across the country saying, hey, such and such passed away. Do you have any photos of him? So, yeah. So you're more of a documentarian too. So one, that's what I do now when I hunt with people, I consciously make it a point. I shoot all the dogs and I shoot all the people.
Yeah.
Just in case, even if I don't know them, even if I'm not even there to take photos of that particular person, because it'll come up. I'm glad it hasn't in a while, but yeah, it'll come up. But.
And pieces will have their time, you know, not every piece is going to be the one you want right now. It might be the one you want in 5 years, not necessarily just a dog, but it could be anything.
Yeah. And that's it. I think it's a trap. It's a trap because you want to get into the perfect photo. You know, you're always striving for that perfect photo. And then when you realize that, man, you know, there's stuff I've taken 10 years ago that never delete a photo. never delete a photo because you always go back and go, wow, that was something. Or that was really cool. Or I really like how I did that. And yeah, I think have someone else look at your work. But yeah, it's a trap that I think all photographers get in. They want that perfect photo. And you do get it from time to time, but
that's probably the case with just about every kind of artist, just trying to get that perfect image or sculpture or, you know, whatever it is, wanting to get to that next bar, I guess.
But I think that's also gives encouragement to everybody because I always say that, you know, I think, you know, of course, talking about phases, there was a point in time where I put myself on a pedestal and thought I was really super, super cool. But man, when you get down to it, everybody can take a perfect photo. All it is one frame. And, you know, I've seen some amazing photos, and that may be the last, you know, it's probably the only great photo that they think they're ever going to make. And, you know, but I think that's what's awesome about cameras and phones and everything else is that anybody can take a great photo at any time. It can just appear.
Sure.
But yeah.
Well, I think I'm going to wrap it up, but I'm going to ask you one more question.
Yeah.
You have a lot of stories on the walls in the Stir building right now. I'm just curious if you have a favorite piece that's in there and the story that goes along with it. What is that story?
Well, yeah, and I know we've talked about this one too. It's probably the photo of all the hunting and fishing stuff. Yeah, it's that photo of Paul and Dan, the guitar people. That was one of the times that I took a chance. I like to drive the back roads. So there's a little triangle basically between North Platte, Denver, and Cheyenne. There's a little triangle of ground through there that I just spent. I mean, I don't want to go to Canada. I don't want to go to Italy. Well, I do want to go to Scotland and catch some big trout on a fly rod. But if I could just go in that area between Denver and Cheyenne and North Platte, if I could just investigate that area for the next 20 years, I'd be more than happy. But that's a little place in Benkelman. And I drove through there. It was dark. It was gloomy. And I just happened to be driving through the town looking at old houses and that. And there was a mandel. There was like, it was like the quintessential golden light coming through the window. And here's this mandolin sitting in the window of this old barbershop. Hmm. And there was a car. There was a pickup truck parked out front, flatbed. And it had two cow dogs in the back. And I look through the window and there's two cowboys playing guitar in there. And I went, gosh, my son plays guitar. And one of my best friends, he plays guitar. And I mean, like I take photos, they play guitar. And I thought, man, if I don't stop and get this story, or at least figure out what's going on here. So I am really an introvert, not an extrovert. But anyway, I went in there and asked him what was going on. And it was Paul and Dan. Paul at that time, I think, was 90. And Dan, I think, was 57. He lived south of town. He's a farmer south of town. But Dan was in World War II, and he was telling me how he was, you know, a pilot and how he used to terrorize people when he got back from World War II, and gave me the story. And you know, he plays guitar with like most people go play golf on Thursday afternoons.
Sure.
Him and Dan would just play guitar, and they were both in a little bit of bands and swing bands and things of that sort. And but that was probably one of the more magical 1 hour time spans in my life, just stopping and hearing their stories. And I've clicked off about 60 photos. And Paul had this Martin guitar, like an original Martin guitar, and I showed it to one of my buddies. Like, my God, like, that guitar's worth like $20,000 or $30,000.
Wow.
It's one of the guitars that everybody wants. But he was Paul, and I've tried to figure out what happened, and just never found out any more about him. And I went back there this year, and the barbershop's closed down. It's the signs off the front. It was a barbershop that came in that basically became just a studio for these guys to go pick. But yeah, looks like nothing's been there for a while, and weeds are growing up, and just one of those that's what I like about that whole area. You've got all these stories of houses and buildings and farm yards that what happened. You know, what's the story here? Why? Yeah. What went wrong or what went right? And there's just a lot of history out there that's, you know, that I'm intrigued with. I'd like to know. But yeah, that's probably one of my favorite photos of all time.
But you stopped and you got that story.
I stopped and I got the story. And yeah, think about it. And yeah, it's some of the best work. I mean, I could do a show just on that set of photos that I took in that hour. It's just amazing.
That image in my head sounds like a Norman Rockwell painting or some kind, you know, pickup truck out front, a couple guys playing guitar and some dogs in the back and a barbershop, barber pole maybe going.
It's just crazy. Yeah. It's like, when I showed the photos to my wife when I first got, my wife's, I think she has great taste, but no, she just saw it. She's like, my gosh, that's amazing. And yeah, but yeah, that's. And that's it. I just have this little knack or niche of seeing that human moment I can find that human moment out in the wild. If you're fishing or just walking and people can relate. And I think that's it. I think, yeah, it's just storytelling. A lot of my photos are storytelling that people can put themselves in that moment or have been there before. I think that's the connection.
I think that's a great place to stop. Doug Stanky, you can see his artwork at the Wings Over the Platte show here at Stir Museum starting February 12th. Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.